Gideon Rachman is the chief foreign affairs commentator at the Financial Times in London. That makes him a very important guy for all kinds of reasons. But what's also interesting is that Gideon was here in South Africa having a look at what occurred in the election, after the election. He met with President Ramaphosa and other people. We're going to find out from him his impressions, because this is a man who tells the world what to think of this country. Gideon, but I suppose the most important thing about all of this is that you have a South African connection, quite a deep one. Your parents were South Africans. You visited here in your childhood. So I guess there is some affection to the country.
Oh, completely. Yeah. No, I mean, I think one of the reasons that I've ended up doing the job I'm doing was indirectly because my parents were South Africans. And there was, growing up in England, it was normal for most of my friends to talk about politics around the table. But of course, if you'd grown up in South Africa, as my parents had, it was a very politicized environment. We talked about politics all the time, and that's a kind of second nature for me. And I lived in South Africa for a few years, and high height of apartheid in retrospect, 67 to 70, when I was like 4 to 7 years old. And then I went back to Britain, but always retained an interest in the country and came back frequently.
We know, the business community knows you well from your weekly column that we publish most times. But maybe if you could just unpack for those who are watching this for the first time, what it is that you do, your job on a day-to-day basis.
Sure. Well, I mean, I have the sort of very wide brief, to put it mildly. I do the sort of global politics column for the Financial Times. So in theory, I could write about almost anything that's happening in the world, but you try to sort of focus in partly on what's going to be of interest to the readers. So we have a sort of big kind of, only 20% of our audience is now in Britain, maybe it's 30%, but so it's a global audience of people who are internationally minded, usually in business, but, not only. We have a lot of kind of academics, diplomats, etc., who read us. And so I write about what the big global political issues shaping the world are, mainly, I guess, US-China, Europe, because we're based in Europe. But whatever I fancy, really, and try to sort of pick out the big trends that will be of interest to the readers.
And always look for balance. And that, I think, is something that's much appreciated.
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously we're in an extremely partisan era now. And I write for the opinion pages, and I'm encouraged to express an opinion, but I'm not naturally a polemicist, I don't think. So, and also, I think that for my audience, they also value analysis. And I think if you're going to try and analyze things and tell people how events might develop, you have to at least be open enough to other points of view that you can sort of understand how they see the world. Because if you don't understand how they see the world, you're going to be constantly surprised. So, I make no bones about it. I'm not a fan of Donald Trump or I wouldn't vote for him. But I try to understand their arguments and where they're coming from, because I think it's important, partly, for sort of reasons of political balance and not just having people write you off immediately as, oh, I know where this guy's coming from. I don't need to get past the first paragraph. I know what the rest is going to be. But also, just to try to further understanding.
And you presumably enlarged on your understanding of South Africa in this recent visit. What was fascinating to me from your column that was published a week ago was that you met with Cyril Ramaphosa at his home when he was very relaxed in a tracksuit. So first of all, meeting with Ramaphosa is something that no South African journalist has done for I can't tell you how long. But secondly, the fact that he trusts you enough to have an off-the-record discussion with you also tells us that you've certainly got some kind of a relationship with him. Just unpack for us what you can tell us about that conversation.
Sure. Yeah, well, I mean, it was firstly an incredibly interesting week to be in South Africa. And I was there actually for other reasons. I'd agreed to speak to a conference. But as it turned out, it was incredibly fortuitous week to be in South Africa because of the election and this sort of historic turning point And I had met Ramaphosa in the past, but I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't say we were friends, or even he'd necessarily even remember who I was. But it was through mutual contacts that I got to see him. And I think somebody said, you know, the FT is important, maybe you should talk to them. And I kind of showed up and I did what a journalist would do and said, look, you know, it'd be great to have an on-the-record interview. And he said, look, I haven't spoken on the record to the South African press, so I don't think I can give my first on-the-record interview to a foreign media, but, you know, since you're here, let's have a chat. So that's what we did. And then at a point in the discussion, he actually sort of said, okay, well, actually, why not? You can put this bit on the record, which was more or less what he had already said to the South African media. I'm calling for a government of national unity, and why he was doing it. So that was, you know, interesting. But I thought, you know, broadly speaking, and it's almost more interesting looking back at it in retrospect, I came away thinking, gosh, this guy seems strangely relaxed for somebody, you know, this incredible turning point. Why is it? And I actually wrote in the column, look, I think that, you know, it wasn't an insight that was unique to me, but that he is hoping, although he didn't say it explicitly to me, even off the record, that MK and the EFF will turn him down. And therefore, he will have made the offer. He won't have excluded them. They'll be, as he put it, people who refuse to take part are excluding themselves. And that was a sort of politically astute way to get to the alliance, broadly speaking, with the DA, without sort of seeming to rush into an alliance with the, you know, the white-led DA. And that's what I thought he was up to, even though, as I say, he didn't quite put it like that way. And it seems to be how events have turned out.
Well, it is a watershed for South Africa. It's been called the second transition. Your former employers, 15 years at The Economist, they say South Africa can still teach the rest of the world something about democracy. Is that overstating it?
No. I don't know whether the world would be watching or taking the lesson, but if you think about it, yes, because what Ramaphosa did, and I know, you know, a lot of the gloss has come off him, and a lot of people are disappointed, both on the left and the right, with him. But what he did is unfortunately becoming quite unusual, or not, you know, or not certainly not routine, which is he lost an election and he did not say, you know, there was fraud, or I don't respect the results, or, you know, I'm carrying on regardless because, you know, come up with some excuse. He actually said, fine, the people have spoken. I don't like what they said necessarily, but I'll take it on board and I will respond to it. And that, you know, if you look at the world's, the leader of the free world, the US, that is not what Donald Trump did. And it's not what actually Zuma did, even though he did strikingly well. Or indeed, people do, you know, unfortunately, in many places around the world now, in places that we had regarded as established democracies, accepting the rules of the game is no longer something that you assume people will do.
Well, it certainly is something that many South Africans are proud about and very hopeful about, given the result and what has happened in the couple of weeks since. But the other people that you met in South Africa, how many of them did you see, and what did you leave here? What impressions did you leave here with?
No, I mean, to be honest, I was at this conference, and so I was less systematic than I would have been if I'd been on a journalistic visit. But no, my impression was that people weren't, you know, obviously people vary, but there was no sense of like panic, but at all, but there was a sort of a strong feeling that it could go either way, you know, that the country was poised between something that could actually be an improvement with new ideas coming in. I think most people, even inside the ANC, and certainly people who are sort of ANC adjacent, accepted that, or not most people in the ANC, but a lot of people accepted that the ANC had sort of run its course and that it was an exhausted party. And that something new needed to happen. But you know, even before I came to South Africa, as you know, there's always been a group of people saying this needs to happen. The ANC needs to lose its majority in power, and we need to move to something new. And then there were others who would say, you know, be careful what you wish for. This could go really badly wrong. And I remember when I wrote that on my previous visit to South Africa, a couple of years ago, and I wrote what was, again, a fairly standard line, and actually, this has got to happen, and we need, you know, kind of the ANC to go below 50%. I think Adam Habib, who's now head of SOAS, wrote a letter to the FT saying, you know, this is actually could be a very dangerous moment, because it's quite likely that the forces that come in will be far worse than the ANC. You know, I think he's thinking of the EFF and others. You know, I was then back in the country at the moment where it could go either way. And for the moment, it looks like it's gone in the way of sort of moderate reform. But I think, you know, it is a hopeful moment, but I think it's also important to temper it with hope so that, you know, one of the people I spoke to who was a DA supporter and an advocate of strong economic reform said to me, you know, you've got to be at least a little skeptical about how much the DA can achieve as junior partners in an ANC-led coalition. And the example this person gave me was, let's say you have a DA minister in charge of the education ministry, where a lot needs to be done. So what happens if they try to take on the teaching unions? Will they be backed? Probably not, you know, so they might not happen. And then, and there was another, you know, one of somebody in business who seemed to me to think that it was actually unwise for the DA to go into coalition, partly, I think, for that reason. They worry that the DA may not be able to deliver on hopes for real improvement for a variety of reasons, that problems are very entrenched, that they don't have, you know, the whip hand in this coalition, they're junior partners, and that therefore the situation won't improve as much as people hope, and it will end up with the DA being discredited or splitting, and therefore the danger of the next thing being actually alert to the radical left being still there. So this person was advocating, well, you know, the DA should support a minority government from the outside and not get its hands dirty with government. I didn't really have a sense myself of how those arguments balanced out, but I was certainly interested to hear them.
Coalition governments, your canvas is the whole world. Where should South Africa be learning lessons from to make this coalition government work?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, well, there's an interesting contrast with the way that South Africa did this so quickly. You know, where you look at, say, in Europe, Belgium and Germany, when they have coalition governments, it can take months, sometimes over a year, to form them. In Belgium, they actually had a sort of caretaker government for 15 months. They even went through a war, the war in Libya, without an actual government, proper government. And the reason is that, certainly on the German model and the Dutch model, actually, they've also just formed a coalition government, is that they hammer out very, very precise coalition agreements. So people don't, nothing is agreed until everything's agreed. So you end up with a sort of a whole bunch of commitments. And there's good and bad to that. The good is that I guess you're less likely to have a sudden breakdown when people say, hang on, I didn't agree to this. You know, we can't live with this, because they've been through the debate beforehand and they've said, okay, well, in the coalition agreement, we agree to this, this, and this. The bad is that to get to that point, you can have the sort of paralysis afterwards. So that, to give you an example from Germany, the current coalition, to put it together, they had to agree to very, very strict levels of government debt because of one of the demands of a junior party, the Free Democrats, who now run the Treasury, the finance ministry. Now, I know a lot of people in the Social Democrats, who are where the Chancellor comes from, believe that this is actually a formula for disaster for Germany. It's tying their hands. It means that, you know, even things like aid to Ukraine become incredibly difficult, and so on. And that, you know, therefore, the very meticulous German way of doing it had its minuses as well as its plus sides. You know, another country that it's going to be faced with incredibly difficult coalition building quite soon, I think, is France, which has legislative elections on June the 30th and then July the 7th, and will, a bit like South Africa, have incredible political opposites. The far right, the far left, a diminishing band of centrists and a centrist president. And how do you form a government out of that? So in some sense, I think the efficiency and pragmatism of the South Africans is pretty striking. I mean, I was astonished when I said to Ramaphosa, you know, this was on the Saturday, you know, you've got this unbelievably tight deadline, it's Friday, do you really reckon you can get it done? He said, oh yeah, no problem. You know, he was really confident they'd do it. And again, that also left me thinking at the time, is this guy, you know, for real? Does he actually you know, either he's really in command of the situation, or he doesn't know what he's dealing with. But it turned out he actually was in command of the situation, at least in the short term. And so, yeah, for somebody who had suffered a big blow, he did seem pretty relaxed, and he didn't seem to have taken it particularly personally. You know, he wasn't somebody who was, you know, you often see politicians who've been defeated, they're kind of going over and over again and how unfair it was, and, you know, this could have happened, that couldn't happen. I mean, Ramaphosa seemed very confident in his position within the ANC and in his ability to get something decent out of this. So much so that I even wondered, I mean, this really is speculation and definitely is not coming from him, but I did wonder, you know, in some weird way, given that he represents the sort of more business-friendly bit of the ANC, might this actually free him to do some of the things that he couldn't do when he was leading a pure ANC government? Because it shifts the balance of political forces a little bit to the right. I mean, that's quite Machiavellian, but maybe that some of that is going on. What do you think? Or are you allowed to say it?
Well, I think you're spot on. I remember once talking to someone from Goldman Sachs who had been the finance minister in the Spanish government. And he said that the Spanish government knew what to do, but they didn't have an excuse until they joined the EU. Once they joined the EU, they can blame everything on the EU. And perhaps we're seeing something here, but it could be Machiavellian, as you say. What should we be looking, what will you be looking for now going forward in the next little while from South Africa?
Well, I mean, I think infrastructure and just generally business-friendly environments, you know, it sends a terrible signal to foreign investors if they arrive in the country and the lights go out. You know, it's almost like a kind of signal of state failure. Things aren't working here. And the ports, you know, I was shocked the week I was in SA that this report came out from the World Bank. Cape Town ranked as the worst container port in the world out of more than 400. I mean, that is, how did that happen? And, you know, there's quite a lot of competition for worst port in the world. You know, it's not a title it's easy to win. So that kind of thing really has to be sorted out. And if they can make progress on it, conversely, I mean, you know, people say if you're really low, it should be quite minimal improvements to actually to start going up those kinds of rankings. And showing to the world that actually this isn't a one-way street. And because that's, of course, the terrible burden that South Africa faces is, you know, sometimes people are too polite to say it, but they say, well, you know, we've seen this in the rest of Africa. We've seen it in Zimbabwe. Once thin salt's going south, they don't turn it round. So if you can actually convince people, well, you know, the country's been through a bad phase associated with Zuma, things are in a bad way, but actually, you know, we can start improving things. They don't have to always get worse. They can also get better. That's really important. And I think there is some hope. I gather people say the energy crisis is not as bad as it was a couple of years ago. Crime, obviously. You know, again, it's shocking to an outsider to be told, to arrive in Joburg and be told, look, you know, don't cross the street, you know, without, you know, take a car. I mean, maybe people are exaggerating the fears and it would all be fine, but the very fact that people advise you don't go here, don't go there, drive here, that's you know, that's actually worse than Rio. You know, it's really not good in terms of a signal. And so again, I don't know how you fix it, but if you can somehow make the environment feel safer and the infrastructure feel better, then that's you know, that's obviously good for investment, but obviously it's poor South Africans who are the biggest sufferers from crime and from collapsing infrastructure, you know, whether it's not being able to get to work or rely on, you know, having safe water. So it's not just for businessmen and investors, but actually this is something everybody has a stake in improving.
Lovely, lovely point you made there about the lights going off and the load shedding that we've had for so long. But the good news is we haven't had it for a few months now, and even after the election, still no load shedding. So it does appear as though we're making progress in the right direction. Before we go, the meeting that Zelensky had from Ukraine, the Ukraine Peace Summit, South Africa didn't sign the pledge to isolate Russia. Is this something that is going to weigh on the country's international reputation? I'd love to get your insights into how the rest of the world sees the way that South Africa's playing this?
Yeah, I mean, again, actually, this was in the off-record bit, but I don't suppose Ramaphosa would mind because I think it's stuff he said publicly. I did talk to him about South Africa's positioning, not just in Ukraine, but on Israel. And he said, look, on Ukraine, we're not pro-Russia as we're portrayed, but we try to stay, you know, talk to both sides. He continues to talk to Putin. I thought he was slightly, you know, as he would with a foreign visitor and is obviously sympathetic to Ukraine, trying to make it, to pretty up the South African position and to make it clear that, as he sees it, they've been unfairly portrayed. And I think, you know, he is saying it is important that the South Africans went, even if they didn't sign the decree. And I think the fact that they're not alone in not signing it gives them some cover. You know, that I think the Brazilians didn't sign, Saudis didn't sign. So there's a kind of emerging global South thing, which is a position of regret in the West, where we, you know, ultimately blame ourselves for not having to made the case sufficiently well, also kind of annoyed with the global South, if I can use that term. But it's sort of known now. And South Africa is, it's an important country. You know, it remains the African country that's invited to these things, to the G20, to the G7, you know, not because it's, yeah, so it's probably the most prominent African country on the international stage. So Ramaphosa, South Africa have weight, and their positions are noted, but they're not that isolated. And similarly, South Africa has led on the ICJ genocide case, and I do think that presents some dangers to South Africa. I mean, you will have followed the whole question of the trade privileges with the US, and Congress is pretty punitive on Israel, on anything that can be characterized as anti-Semitism, whether that's fair or unfair. And so I think it does potentially threaten South Africa's trade privileges. But, you know, for now, they seem to have blunted that. And I think South Africa is helped a little bit by the fact that other case countries, including Western countries, you know, are joining the ICJ case. So the Spanish, the Irish, the, I think Slovenians have also signed up. And again, that gives South Africa a bit of cover. In the West, for those who say, look, why are you doing this? And of course, you know, it's not just the West that exists, because in other parts of the world, I think South Africa has been applauded for taking the lead, for sticking its neck out on this issue. So, yeah, you know, I think you could argue, well, you know, the country's got quite a lot of problems of its own to be getting on with. Does it really need to be taking this very high international profile? But that's something for the political leadership to decide on. I think it's not, as I say, without risks, but for the moment, I think it's a kind of balance for the South Africans. One wonders what happens if and when Donald Trump comes to power. I think on Ukraine, actually, he will probably cut the Ukrainians off. So, you know, maybe the global South will get to say, told you so, you know, this was not a sustainable position. On Israel, however, I think he'll become much more militant, and I think the Republicans will be let off the leash in taking on people that are seen to be unfriendly to Israel. So there, that could become a more difficult position for South Africa.
Well, there's some big red flags waving there. Gideon Rochman, who is the Chief Foreign Affairs Commentator at the Financial Times of London, and I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.